Hey everybody, Sean jumping in here with a quick party update. The ILC of New York City is having its first monthly mixer. It's going to be this coming Sunday, March 1st at 96 Tiers, 110 Avenue A on the Lower East Side.
That's a cool bar.
Fuck yeah.
It's punk as fuck.
We got punk as fuck, and we're going to have DJs, and we're going to have drinks. It's at 3 p.m., folks, March 1st, 3 p.m. at 96 Tiers. Andy will be there. We hope to see you there at the ILC of NYC Social Mixer.
All right, you get to get started?
Dude, I'm born ready. Blizzard 2.0, let's fucking go.
Okay,
the snow is falling outside, Mark.
We're in the Varn Zone once again. We're here with the erudite Sigma Marxist, the social studies professor.
Genius.
Cornelius Derek Varn. Thank you for joining us once again. We had to get you on because there's so much stuff we want to cover. Yeah. And, you know, it's always helpful to have you as a voice of info and analysis.
A sounding board, if you will. This is what happens when, like, see Derek Varn, Cornelius Derek Varn, you devote yourself to young minds, is that your own mind becomes powerful, like that meme where it just overgrows out of the walled garden of your skull and just, you know, its tendrils just wrap themselves around everything. So good to have you on, man.
Thanks. I mean, you know, there's a thousand things to follow right now, and it feels like every day I wake up and read the news and I'm just like, okay, how do I sort all this? Because it's a barrage of shit.
Well, what you have to do is you have to max something. Like, you know, I read this article about clavicular and looks maxing, and I didn't realize this, but that term maxing doesn't come from the incel manosphere community. It comes from D&D, and it's when you put all your stats onto one category.
Right, okay.
Like charisma or Marxist knowledge or something like that.
Or beating your face with hammers.
Yeah. Min-max.
So So maybe you should just tariff max, and I can looks max, and Sean can worker max.
Worker max.
And together we'll form a good team.
We'll be able to get into the dungeons, save the princess, defeat the Balrog, whatever the fuck else it is you do in D&D. Sorry for all my 32-headed dice people out there.
You're probably a D&D guy, right?
Yeah, I am. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am. I used to run a show on it with Gene Bagelon until it got its own economic problems. It made it unfun to talk about because all we were talking about was Hasbro's financial decisions that month.
Oh god, that's what happens when Marxists try to start a D&D show. Yeah. Just let open the books. Yeah. I find the look maxing thing, I at first I was like, what the fuck? How could anybody pay attention to this? It's so dumb. But then I realized that it's like filling a niche for a certain cohort of people that used to be filled by like some combination of pro wrestling and Days of Our Lives. It's like Days of Our Lives for men because they keep introducing all of these new characters.
The ASU frat leader.
ASU frat leader who doesn't have a name.
Androgenic. The Orlando Asian Mogger, of course.
Of course. We all know these characters. We have their cards at home, like baseball cards. You know, you should be able to get look maxing cards. I like ASU frat leader the best because he doesn't have an actual like given or Christian name. Yeah. He's like a character in River City Ransom.
And he doesn't talk. He just mogs.
Yeah, he just mogs. And he's got that frame, man. I mean, if you're going to get frame mogged by anyone, it may as well be the ASU frat leader. I find that millennials and people me and Varn's age, which is like Xennials or whatever, maybe probably even Gen X too, are titillated by this whole look maxing thing because it allows them to like pick up a new lingo that makes them feel cool. You know, like when the Chapo Trap House guys get to use all the lingo, when what's his face, Adam Friedland, has the clavicular guy on his show and he gets to be like, so when you mogged that dude, and you get to feel young and cool.
I just like the way some of those words sound, munting and mogging. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it was like E.B. White or not E.B. White, E. Cummings. Yeah.
it's a very poetic way to talk about drug addiction and doing things that are going to kill you by your 35.
But yeah, they're beatniks. they're modern beatniks. That's exactly what I'm saying.
You know what Varn, you have to understand that Andy and I have a new podcasting HQ, and it's in downtown Manhattan, you know, like near the Dime Square kerfuffle down there. Cool, actually, if you could believe it, for old people like me. But one thing that somebody pointed out, which I think is true, is that this clavicular fellow, is that his name? Clavicular?
That is. You get so many names wrong and you get clavicular perfect.
I'm a savant when it comes to this look maxing trend. Somebody pointed out that, like, 50 years ago, he would have been still addicted to methamphetamines, but he would have been in, like, probably in Andy Warhol's loft, and he would have been in some, like, softcore gay pornography sort of, like, realistic thing shot on a 35mm black and white camera, talking about beauty and life and, like, shooting speed. And now we don't have that anymore. We don't have, like,
Now everyone has it. Now we all get to be Andy Warhol just gazing at clavicular and going, oh, wow. Oh, wow. He's so beautiful. All right, let's get into the news.
Let's get into it. Okay.
We got clavicular out of the way. That's the most important story. Well, let's talk about the nursing strike. This is a big strike that just ended in New York. It was a victory, but maybe a bit of a Pyrrhic victory. It was one of the largest strikes, the largest nurse strike in New York history, the largest labor strike in quite some years. And have you been following this, Varn?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think the winds are, I mean, I'm gonna sound like I always sound when we talk about labor stuff. It's like, yay, labor, good. Also, this is all gonna be undone by counter trends that we can already see happening immediately.
Yeah, it wouldn't be the Varn
so
zone without
talk that about
attitude.
It a little bit. I mean, they got a 12% raise over 3 years and enforceable staffing ratios, whatever that means. But we're still getting hit by the Medicaid cuts. We're still going to see the introduction of AI guardrails, which is going to be interesting in nursing. It's almost unavoidable because things in the Big Beautiful Bill are going to make getting more nurses even more difficult, at least if you want nurses with a skill level above an LPN. Because there's now caps on, like, nurse practitioner loan funding.
Student loan funding.
Yeah, student loan funding. Because it's no longer considered a professional degree, whatever the fuck that meant, but it changes the amount of loans you can get from the federal government. We already have a broad-based medical shortage, but the other thing is medical care is the only aspect of our economy outside of AI that's actually growing.
Right.
So this is what makes it so important. Yeah. And the Medicaid cuts that you mentioned, and I assume AI is part of this as well, is what justified Cedars-Sinai and New York Presbyterian to do the cuts initially that led to this big strike. And so the major issue of the strike was staffing, nurse to patient ratio, security for nurses. And it seems like they had some compromises that the Sinai nurses were happy with, but the Presbyterian nurses rejected the contract and then filed some proceedings against their own union for trying to force it through anyway, or trying to go around I wasn't exactly sure the procedural drama there, but eventually the Presbyterian nurses accepted it too. So I think they're all going back to work, including some friends of mine. So that's good. I mean, it's good for the nurses and for the patients. But yeah, I agree. It sounds like these are problems that are just sort of pushed off until maybe the next contract or the next round of cuts. Because even though this is a growing, huge industry, there is still austerity going on within it.
A couple of weeks ago, I went up to one of the picket lines, as we are wont to do. We like to go to the pickets. We love the pickets, don't we, folks? And we went, and there was a lot of energy. There was it was very cool. There was a DJ. There was a band that was kind of like a punk neo-folk band that was playing. I thought that was
a neo-folk band?
Yeah. It was like what are the... I'm not even sure. It was like neo-folk. Remember like back at all those protests like 20 years ago?
You're talking about folk punk. You're not talking... Neo-folk is like the Nazi genre. No. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank God, yeah, Andy corrected.
Weirdly, there are a subset of anarchists in Europe who are into neo-folk sure and make their like contra-neo-folk thing.
Yes,
it's
national anarchism.
It's kind of like
anarchism.
The Oi Oi Wars of the 90s, if you know anything about that shit. Uh-huh. But that's O-I versus O-Y.
Oy vey. We went up there and we enjoyed spending time with the Strikers, spoke with them. The band was like one of those, it was like all cymbals and brass, one of those bands. Anyways, there was some energy there. It was clear that they were going to be in it for the long haul. There is a local political aspect to this, or to say a state aspect to it. Our mayor... Mayor Zoran Mamdani, people may have heard of them, the socialist.
Mamdani, get it right.
Mamdani.
We'll be okay.
Thank you very much. I could get clavicular, but I can't get our mayor. Damn it.
Yeah, be good about that. I've been corrected many a time by DSAers for not saying his name right.
Fair
enough. Because it has political influence.
Friend of Jeffrey Epstein, according to C. Derek Varn.
Did you say that?
My mother was a distant friend of Jeffrey Epstein. Although apparently... The stupid picture was fake.
Yes. And be careful, everybody.
We're already hitting.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're already hitting a thing where I no longer trust any visual evidence over written evidence, because written evidence I can check and visual evidence is like completely fucking fake now.
It's kind of... I have a whole take on that, how that's actually good. It's like the whole hypnosis of the internet is like dying in front of our eyes because you can't trust anything anymore. But what I was going to say is that Governor Hochul, if I'm pronouncing your name correctly, our governor here in New York, has got some plaudits for like negotiating with or siding with Zoran to try to do some of the initiatives that he wants to do, free busing, childcare, whatever. However, in this case, we have to look at the limitations of Hochul in Albany, because there's basically like a scab. What would you even call it? Like scab, like basically every 2 weeks she can sign this permit, which allows
the traveling nurses
to come and work in our state.
Because they're supposed to be licensed in New York. And because of the strike, she did an emergency order that allowed travel nurses to work for longer.
And she did it 8 times. So she kept renewing the thing. So it's basically like,
but you know, Larry, let me play devil's advocate here, because I don't, you know, I don't know a lot about this, and correct me. Like, you do need, it's not like we want the hospitals to be shut down. Like, people rely on nurses to live at these hospitals.
Yeah.
So, I'm not really sure what the option is.
No, I'm not sure either. I mean, obviously the governor's role is to try to make sure that things like hospitals are still operating. It kind of shows, I think, the limitations of the strike in general, the strike in this particular industry, the ability of workers in one state to like fend off replacement workers from other states. When it's a political question, when it's revolving around hospitals and issues of life and death, I should point out that when I was at the picket line, it was at the Children's Hospital up in Harlem, otherwise known as the Morgan Stanley Children's Hospital. So there's tons of money here, right? Like, there are tons of capitalists who are donating to like build new wings of hospitals. I think they spent $100 million on traveling nurses over the last couple months or whatever in order to try to break the strike. And it's not surprising that our governor is helping, that is signing these special dispensations to get traveling nurses into this state. However, it should make us realize, I think, the limitations of sort of like not unionism, but like social democracy, even in one state, if you can't jigger things so that you're getting like maybe other union workers from New York to cover the things. Instead, you're relying on the governor to go out of state.
What do you think, Farhan? If you were the governor of New York, how would you have handled
the
nurses' strike?
I think I would have probably done what the governor did. Right.
There you have it.
I mean, like, nurses can strike in the Northeast, which is good at least because they can't hear, not legally. And I think that's an interesting phenomenon. I mean, for example, teachers, we've had calls to see if we'd strike. We don't. I mean, we can't legally do it. And our union leadership has not even allowed us many times to see the results of the votes for a call for a strike, even when they called it. So it doesn't really surprise me in the sense that, like, nurses don't go on strike easily, even in radical places like New York, because they understand the cost of what they do. And there's always going to be a need for that labor, because otherwise you have a bunch of elderly deaf, which would also, frankly, hurt the nurse's case. If you look like you're willing to kill a bunch of old people, right. The public tends to turn against you fairly quickly.
Only former Governor Cuomo is always
go ahead.
I said only former Governor Cuomo is allowed to do that, like he did during COVID. But I was just a quip. Go ahead. Continue.
No, but this is always actually an issue with key logistics sector unionization. Nurses have a lot of power. They have a lot of influence in the community. And unlike a lot of things, they're still concentrated in like almost industrial style shops. Mm-hmm. I know we don't think of it that way, but like a hospital will have what? 2,000 nurses.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like a half a Ford plant.
Right. In the 70s. They're meaningful in that sense. But there's always the danger that if you don't have significant political outreach in your community to back you up, that there'll be sectoral tensions. I mean, famously, people turned on a lot of the railroad unions in the early 20th century for striking for too long. And it was other unions who turned against them. Mm. And we don't talk about this in like Marxist and anarchist circles all that much, because we like to believe in like universal working class solidarity. And that's why there's been such a push in the teachers unions, particularly in Chicago, to do things like social unionizing so that they can have the social support to do this, the labor actions, because otherwise it's going to be seen as a drag on the economy and it's going to hurt. It's going to be seen as hurting other parts of the working class, including parts that are actually less well off. And so nurses always consider that when they strike. I mean, the thing about nurses unions is nurses are educated, but they're the most proletarianized part of the medical workforce, other than like, you know,
AIDS,
janitors,
janitorial janitors, and AIDS
security.
Right.
And, you know, I think another aspect of it is just, like I said, the austerity, you know, the when we talk about Cuomo killing all these elderly folks is because they reduce the number of retirement homes. And so more elderly people were in a smaller space and COVID just rampages through there. And that was because he decided to cut healthcare during COVID, which was horrifying to the left, but everyone loved Cuomo at the time. So I had the opportunity to do it. And I think, you know, maybe if all these hospitals hadn't closed over the last couple decades, a social democratic governor, or like a very pro-worker governor, could have said, well, these hospitals might have to close or go to basic minimums and everyone else can go to other hospitals or something. Well, I'm not sure if that's even plausible, but the lack of hospitals that we have, a couple of chains closing down is catastrophic for public health.
They shut down your local hospital like 5 years ago, Andy St. Vincent's, right? Mm-hmm. Which was downtown.
It's condos now.
Now it's condos. It's great. What I want to say, and I, you know, I think Varn is correct that if you're Governor Hochul, right, you don't want your state's hospitals to shut down, the private or the public ones, right, from lack of nurses. So obviously that was deemed acceptable by her as a Democratic governor. Like this strike is revolving ultimately around staffing issues and hours and job seniority, things that, you know, a union in its collective bargaining can work with management around, can fight for. And so there's like, if the nurses union was strong enough, association, I should say, was strong enough, they could, you could conceive of there being an all hands on deck sort of thing. Like during COVID, my aunt and uncle, who were both nurses, but had moved up into like sort of middle management, got bumped down and were ended up on the floor again, like doing respiratory work and whatever, because of the lack of nurses. You could imagine a situation where the nurses association could do an all hands on deck approach and have the traveling nurses be their nurses from other parts of New York State. Right. But this is all contingent upon there being enough workers' power to basically move to make very real the promises of the contract, which is that the union will control staffing, right? If it was moving workers like from upstate New York or from Long Island into the city to make things happen within the association, it could be more powerful. But barring that, you know, of course you can't let the Morgan Stanley Children's Hospital in Harlem shut down, because that'd be a social disaster, of course. And as Varn rightfully said, nursing, teaching, things of this sort are things that ultimately are deeply social, and you will get pushback if hospitals start to shut down.
I do think this kind of leads me to another question on staffing, because it comes up in education a lot. You know what we've done in education to handle a staffing issue?
What nothing. Have you done? Laptops?
Wheeling in the TV?
Yeah, nothing. I mean, I've been under overtime now for 2 years. I'm now under double overtime as a teacher, which means that if I was in person, it would mean I would have no planning periods ever. And what it means for me online is that I work a formally 60-hour week. I get paid for it, but you know, I've been in double overtime now for 2 years. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you why there's nothing to fix it. The teachers aren't there. They don't exist. Like, yes, there's like when I, at my job, when we open up, there's 40 applications for anything, and we're getting teachers with 10 years of experience because they went out of the classroom. Mm-hmm. But if you are trying to hire new teachers right now, it's gotten a little better. The reason why, and this is where things get a little dark in nursing, but the reason why they're not fixing it is that once population rates correct and we've shut down so much immigration, the schools are going to lose about 10 to 20% of their expected enrollment anyway, and we will actually meet the staffing needs. So this is considered now just a temporary problem to rate out, even though we've been having it for 20 years.
So due to demographics, like attrition is going to take care of things. I assume the hospitals
are nursing too.
Right. Like in 15 or 20 years, many of the boomers, much of the boomer generational cohort bump will be dead. Basically, right? They will have died off at that point.
And Gen Xers are also dying younger than boomers anyway.
It's a very Swiftian take on like the falling life expectancy of the American population.
But if you're Governor Hochul or you're the CEOs of New York Presbyterian Hospital or
were thinking about it because that's what your actuarials are telling you.
And you have to.
For sure. Right?
Yeah, because if you lock into a contract that can't be revoked, or if there's pattern bargaining, which means that you'll be saddled with all this extra staffing after all the boomers die, after the boom times are over, then of course, right, it's worth now for them to have this fight, to fight it out, to keep staffing levels low, to keep nurses overworked, to keep their labor budgets down. Because in the future, they're not going to need as many workers, they think.
I mean, this is true. This is going to be true in several fields. And this is, I don't think the timing of pushing out LLMs was an accident. I really don't. Not to sound conspiratorial, but a lot of the technology behind LLMs we have known about for a long time.
I was using Smarter Child as a kid. That's like the same thing.
Right. The emergent quality of using massive models is what is different. And even that was known by, I think the paper on that was like 2019. Mm. But the big push for it came a few years in. Now we're, you know, literally telling people that we're going to make God, which from all energy calculations would take the energy of the entire fucking sun to do. Because AI is not particularly energy efficient. And we're betting everything on it. And that's falling apart at the very moment that also we're tying. I mean, have you guys thought that there's probably now crypto helping like legally back up medical portfolios and stuff because they can be included in endowments now?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yep.
And that's leading to margin calls everywhere. So I do think this is going to be a crucial and important fighting line in the next 2 to 3 years. But I also think it's going to look a lot, if we're not careful, it's going to look a lot like what happened to the auto unions in the 2000s, which was in some ways, we always think of Reagan as breaking the unions back, but it was actually the 2007 recession is where you see the biggest drop off in unionization in America, like at a single time in the after unionization upticked in the 20th century. Mm.
Thanks, Obama.
Yeah, one other quick labor hit I wanted to mention before we move on is about the strongest union in the United States, which is, of course, the Major League Baseball Players Association. I'm not, you know, in the 90s, it was considered the strongest union. I'm not sure if it still is. And it's I
think it's the cop unions now, but
I didn't see the ball players or the cops down at the fucking nurses rally. So I don't know. They're falling on their face in solidarity. Oh, spring training. They're all insane. They're all in Florida, I guess. Right.
Yeah. So, I think 2 weeks ago, or just last week, Tony Clark, the longtime president of the MLBPA, the first president who was a professional ball player, resigned. He claims he resigned because he was in a relationship with his sister-in-law, and that came to light. But it seems like the true story is that he was using some of the massively unknown revenues from player rights contracting that they share with the NFL to fund these kind of no-show jobs through a player development nonprofit, which was given a no-bid contract to a for-profit players academy. Oof. And so it just seems like a big chunk of the union is just sort of moving dark money around, and which could have been fine until the team owners got wind of it and used this as for leverage to try to get a salary cap moving into next year's CBA negotiations.
Like what you did is dire when you have to fall back on, like, I was only fucking my sister-in-law.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what you've really done is bad when you're like, it's just my brother's wife.
That's literally what he did.
Incredible stuff. The dark money thing is really interesting. I think it says something about our economy. Maybe this is a good time to move to tariffs.
Yes.
Yeah. We could talk about tariffs.
We will be talking a lot about baseball in the coming months.
As Andy's book comes out.
I'll try to keep it a tasteful amount, but that's a little preview of coming attractions.
Yeah. The 10% of our fans who come here for the baseball updates, 5%.
Yeah, I mean, the tariffs are going to be interesting to talk about since we just had a Supreme Court showed the division in the bourgeoisie in a way between the three conservative justices who voted against tariffs and the three that are partisan Trumpers. And I think it is actually kind of funny that two of the three partisan Trumpers are not Trump appointees.
Who are the Trumpers? Clarence Thomas,
Alito. Clarence Thomas, Alito, and
Kavanaugh. Okay.
Kavanaugh. And so only one of them is a Trump appointee. And I mean, it's also clear to me that, like, this actually seems to reflect where capital is right now in regards to the Trump administration.
Yeah.
Is they don't really want the Democrats. No one wants the Democrats. I mean, Democrats are winning, so I guess some people want the Democrats, but also Democrats are winning with, like, no money. Uh-huh. If you look at the money uptakes for the last, like, Since Obama,
Democrats are winning like Labor won in the last election. Like, at with what plan and at what cost? It's such a pyrrhic
bingo.
Mystery.
It is like, okay, so we're gonna get a Keir Starmer Democrats.
Right.
If we've seen the way that goes, if the UK is any indication as what's that gonna mean for us, it might be a worse than Biden world historic disaster.
Absolutely. And it could be AOC. That would be incredible. That'd be incredible kismet. But back to the tariffs, the as I understand it now, Trump has attempted to, well, let's back up a second. Trump's whole thing is that he used emergency tariffs.
The IEEPA to set tariffs. That's the International Emerging Economic Powers Act of 1977.
Right, and he was using this to beat other nations over the head or threaten them, and he was able to, and this is very Trumpian, right? He was able to, in certain cases, with certain allied countries, certain neutral countries, to go in and basically threaten the tariffs and say, invest such and such amount of money, $26 billion, I think it was, that was it South Korea, was meant to invest in the United States, or else we're going to hit you with 35% tariffs. Now, he did the same thing with the European Union and a lot of different nations. Whether those investments were ever going to come to fruition, I think, is an open question, because they were, they need to be passed in many cases by the legislatures of these foreign countries, which is very much up in the air. And B, there was a sense that, like you're seeing Ukraine and everywhere, that if you just wait out the next few years, there'll be another administration in effect and you'll never have to give $50 billion for auto plants or whatever investment in the United States. So now Trump has fallen back on, I think, a more normal, less Trumpian, more historically normal form of tariffs, which is like a across the board first 10% and then 15%, which they're arguing that they have statutory powers to do, not based on the act that Varn mentioned, but instead based upon other acts that supposedly maybe will pass constitutional muster this time. So we're back to square one, but now we got 15% tax tariffs.
So what he's invoking now is Section 301 and Section 122 of the Trade Act of 1974. Also, he's invoking FDR time period legislation that gives some provisional presidential provisions over tariffs. The IEEPA was struck down because it literally talks about regulations and does not mention tariffs, taxes, or duties at all, and requires an emergency to be granted. I mean, and Trump has been granting himself emergency powers like mad. I mean, that's, and we should have seen it coming, because we've known that since Nixon, and definitely since George W. Bush, granting emergency powers is what the government does whenever it wants to do something at this point.
Not to interrupt you, but I think you've put your finger on something really important, which is that, like, the basis that Trump argued that he needed to do these emergency tariffs go up was that only he can fix it. This is the argument that he's made for many, many years at this point, but at least 10 years. He said, only I can fix it. So instead of relying on the Congress, for example, right? I think this is the important point. Instead of relying on Congress to pass these, what's basically a taxation, the whole premise from the very beginning is that only he could fix it through these hard-nosed negotiations with other nations, which already presupposes that Congress has failed at its duties, that, like, this has to be an executive branch thing, that, in fact, that it's only emergency powers that are going to get us out of this mess, and it's only aggrandizement of the executive branch that will do that. So now that this is, that the Supreme Court has struck it down, there isn't a sense, maybe you guys have read something I haven't read, that, like, Congress is now going to step up and start taking its due constitutional powers seriously. Instead, it's a series of workarounds that this administration is going to try to use legally, like the whole John Yoo torture memos, right? They're going to try to find some sort of way to finagle their way around it while continuing to aggrandize executive power, presidential power.
Yeah, I mean, what is interesting about this is this limits the amount you can throw on a country, and it limits the time So for that, if you're invoking these under Section 301, you can't like do a 50% tax in Brazil. If you invoke Section 122, you can do a high level one, but it's got to be, I think, for less than 12 months. Or no, it's no more than 150 days. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, some of these laws have never actually even been invoked before, so they will be decided by the invocation by the president and how that plays through the courts. I mean, assuming that courts matter, because we're, the other thing about this current administration is like it is the it doesn't win most of its court battles, but it is not complying with all kinds of a rule of law issues. It's just not. I mean, you know, we saw this in Minnesota. We're still seeing this now. You know, you were talking about this in terms of, you know, us with Britain, but if you think about like what happens, okay, Democrats come to power, in Congress, if assuming that all the scaremongering, which may not be from nothing, I may add, I call it scaremongering, but it's not completely impossible this time, that we're going to have such a contested election that no one's going to seek Congress in 2007. There just won't be one because Trump's going to argue that the elections are invalid and Johnson's going to refuse to seat any new Congress. And so they'll just be in absentia for like, I don't know, 2 years, which has also never happened.
Yeah. I didn't even hear that as a possibility, but go on.
Well, it's never happened before.
Yeah.
But the current Congress has to swear in the new one.
Huh. And this is a lever similar to like the electors in what was the contested election 20, like the Jan 6 election, the idea of Pence refusing to seat the electors to overthrow the election. There's a similar sort of procedural thing is what you're saying that they could use.
Yeah, it's possible. It's not necessarily legal, but again, it's not necessarily not. It's never been done before.
I think his instinct here is that he understands the pushback he was getting when he was trying to roll out the tariffs in his first term was from the capitalist class. Mm-hmm. And his true power as a populist is appearing to be against the elites, against the swamp, and against capital to some extent. America First, in a way, has these sort of right-wing anti-capitalist implications to it, is that we're going to be against the globalists, which means the global economy in some to some extent. And, you know, it's one thing to saber rattle against Soros and, you know, other factions of the elite that he doesn't like. It's another thing to go against the entire global economy. And what's interesting this time is like the press and like most politicians and like everyone else, everyone's kissing Trump's ass on this. It's like everyone is kind of hoping that if we cut deals with Trump, if we're nice to him, if the vibes are right when we meet him, if we have Trump whisperers who can talk to him, then we can reduce the damage of these tariffs and like sort of treat him like a crisis that will pass. And this New York Times article that Sean posted, "Murky Waters for Global Businesses After Trump's Tariff Loss" by Patricia Cohen, it sort of argues that the global economy has been remarkably resilient, yes, considering the chaos of all this. And what the markets really want more than anything else is just an indication of like stability. Like if you want to set it at 10%, you want to set it at 15%, we can plan for that. We can work around it. We survived COVID. We survived the financial crisis. We can survive this too. It just can't keep changing. And the rollback is also part of this chain, part of the volatility. And so this is why I think they gave him these loopholes to keep doing it, but just try to like remind him that there is this check. And Trump very correctly pointed out when he was like raging against the Supreme Court justices for ruling against him on this, that they're lapdogs, that they're in the thrall of foreign interests, right? I mean, this is like, you know, this is FDR talk in a way.
He's waving the bloody shirt, you know? This is like the old Trump, right?
Of course, Trump isn't doing this for anti-capitalist reasons. He's doing it because he wants the capitalist class to be in his thrall, just like everyone else's. He wants the entire world to be sort of organized around him on this board of peace thing, right? Which, you know, the implication of that is like, if you don't join the board of peace, then we're going to make war on you. This is just another aspect of his, he's like the king of this global mind palace. Huh. And we all kind of have to pretend to be a part of it for a little while. But at some point, like if the volatility gets high enough, there's going to be some sort of major international revolt against him doing whatever he wants and making the rules whatever he wants, whether it comes to tariffs or it comes to the future of U.S. elections and the future of U.S. democracy. The question is, how long can he keep everyone in his thrall, keep everyone at heel?
Yeah, well, there's
Minnesota's an indication, not very long.
Right. I mean, he's not immune to public pressures, and certainly he's not immune to market pressures. Right. We've seen him chicken out before when it comes to, you know, sell offs and things of that sort. So I want to address two things that Andy said. I think they're separate, but maybe they're related, right? And the first gets back to what I was saying before, only I can fix it. Andy's talking about the personalistic nature of this presidency, ultimately of this movement, right, of what Trumpism is. This is something that scares the bejesus out of anybody who, you know, grew up with this notion that if you're a public servant, you pledge an oath to the Constitution, not to a particular person. This is different. This is like a Caesarian sort of breaking through the muck and mire, a personalistic regime of a president, which we haven't had before. And so it is like it we should be aware.
I would disagree with you. We have had it before. We had it during World War II. It was okay. It was the third administration of FDR.
Okay.
But I would also say what is different is that the institutions of the modern administrative state under FDR were brand new and powerful because they were brand new and came in through the war itself. And so they were able to push back and use Congress to do so in very effective ways. It really was a limit on FDR's power. Today, you're looking at an administrative state that is remarkably weaker than everyone thought it was.
Yes, that's true.
Like even in the military where we're like, there's no way they're going to let some Fox News jerk off with borderline Nazi tattoos, like just boss around the internal organs of the Pentagon. Yeah. And they may not be, to be quite frank, there does seem to be limits on Hegseth's ability to do shit.
Well, but now the debate on him is, did he really bench 315 or were those plates fake? You know, that's the debate went from
clavicular politics.
Are they really going to confirm this guy to like, did he really bench 315?
Right. I mean, so what we really see today is like, it's not just that the Bonapartist emperor has no clothes. I think that's somewhat obvious, and Minnesota in some ways proves it. I mean, they were going out and saying what every liberal, borderline conspiracy theorist believed, that they were going to use ISIS shock troops to stop to intimidate voters in the next election. And it's very clear that, frankly, they don't have the shock troops to do that. Like, look at how many they mobilized in Minnesota.
3,000
did.
Yeah.
I said, you know, when Trump issued this, whatever he does on True Social about how they were going to pass this new thing by executive order, even if Congress couldn't get the SAVE Act through, which is basically it's almost the most explicit, not subtle voter suppression bill I've ever seen. It probably still wouldn't work to save the GOP at this point, which is why so many of them are retiring. Despite the fact that they thought they could get to the House, they were still retiring. So a lot of them know that this is A, not going to help them as much as they think, because it really suppresses married women who are, you know, married white women were slightly favored Trump in the last election. So this is not even something that necessarily cuts their direction.
Why is that? How does that affect married women?
Because the SAVE Act actually requires you to have your same name on your documentation if you don't have a passport. And who has passports?
Liberal women.
Elites.
Yeah,
liberal. Now, elites. The most paranoid liberals I know say that means they're just going to start invalidating passports willy-nilly based off of your voter data. But again, I have a hard time seeing them being able to pull that off. What that would lead to is what it would lead to is about three steps to a civil war.
Well, the airlines are not going to like that too much.
Well, there's a bunch of things that they wouldn't like. I mean, the reason why I said it leads to like three steps to a civil war, if it actually happened, and I don't think it will, but here's what it does. I don't see blue states giving money to the federal government at that point, which would invoke Texas versus white, which means that the federal government would claim that their legislatures and governors are invalid. You'd have a division amongst the National Guards of who's going to side with the federal governments and who isn't. And it would lead to a shooting war, period. Like legally, if you follow the statutes, it would lead to a shooting war in the country. I don't see them doing that.
Talk about market volatility, huh?
But, you know, the courts have also stopped Trump from trying to withhold all funding to blue states off of fiat multiple times successfully. Partly because if they did that, there's no reasons for the blue states to continue paying into the federal government. And again, that triggers Texas versus white, and there you go. So
let's bring it back a little bit to the current moment, because I think what we're sort of circling around here is the question of opposing Trump's worst excesses and who's organized to do it. And
I had a second point that I was going to bring up about the volatility thing you brought up, Andy, but we can come back to it if it doesn't fit in.
The one thing we can say is American capital is both very strong and very weak right now. I mean, we talk about who has the strength to do it, but what areas of capital have money?
Well, this is only
the AI stuff, and that seems to be all fictitious.
Yeah, well, this is what I wanted to bring up, because it's easy to say capital, you know, big C capital, but obviously there are divisions, as we pointed out, reflected in a lot of aspects of governance and society and the economy, and different factions of capital. And I think there is a fraction of capital that's needing that stability that Andy was talking about. They need their rate of return. This is monopoly capital. This is obviously multinational corporations as they exist, commercial capital in the United States. But there are also, it seems, and we know this from previous periods, from like the 1980s, you know, greed is good times, that there are sectors of capital that thrive off of chaos, you know, that thrive off of disruption. And I feel like one of the bets that's being made right now is that American political economy, let's say, is so under threat right now from outside forces, primarily China, but not only China, that there's a put here. There's a bet that a certain degree of volatility is going to lead to a new political economy in this country that could build broad-based growth, that could be a manufacturing-led growth, that you could claw back some of this production. You could nearshore, friendshore, reshore production to the United States. That's not happening as of yet, but this is, we need to acknowledge the bet that it seems that the Trump administration has taken. And this, the vulture capital, you call it, financial capital, the aspects of this, of American capital, which thrive on the opportunity that arises out of chaos, I think have been fine with it, with what's been happening over the last year. And so maybe it's a battle between these two factions of capital right now we're seeing.
Well, in which case, Britain is our model.
Oh, awesome. Fucking Britain. They're going to shit right now.
In seriousness, because if you are dominated by finance capital and your production is limited in a real way, like the United States, for all we talk about the finance stuff is more profitable, but we are a real industrial powerhouse still. Mm-hmm. I know it doesn't seem like it because it employs so few people, but Aaron Benyevev has proven like a decade ago why that is. Like the organic composition of capital is gotten to the point where you just don't need to exploit that many people in highly productive industries. You're stuck in services. You're stuck in governmental industries, which cannot be made efficient. Ironically, those are national industries. The international industries now are in many ways much lower profit rates unless they are warrant seeking. The thing is, what rent-seeking regime is going to enforce it when you have China doing whatever it's doing and the EU beginning to buckle under our arbitrary decisions and
their own arbitrary decisions.
The UK's a basket, but
yeah.
The UK's a basket case. So they are seeming to wait this out, not just because, I mean, you'll hear whispers that, you know, there'll never be an election in America again abroad. I don't know that that's true, but you hear it. But they also just know Trump's not going to live forever. I mean, yeah. Like, assuming that he doesn't go completely down the dementia pathway like his father did and makes it to 90, that's still only a decade. Mm. Now, I can't imagine what things look like if we have 14 years of Trump or whatever, okay. Particularly given that he's already seemingly physically and mentally fading now.
Mm-hmm. Seems to have a really nice cocktail of the narcissism that he's had for decades and Alzheimer's kicking in at the same time, which is very fun.
It's a heady mix, a heady brew.
But you know, this leads me to the tariffs thing. One, a lot of liberals are making it sound like the average person's going to benefit from these tariff refunds. They're not. They might see an end to the climbing of prices, but there is nothing inherent that leads businesses to cut prices back down if they think the consumer market can hold it. And we are currently living in a K-shaped consumer market. Uh-huh. We have a similar economy to like Guatemala City, which is like 10% of the population does 50% of all consumer spending right now. Now, that is being hit for different reasons because there's volatility around crypto, because AI is beginning to look too effective in certain industries and not effective enough in others, and the market's reacting negatively to both. Mm. So this, you know, whole 5% GDP, which is all basically moving money from the Cayman Islands into AI, all that money that came in from the Cayman Islands in 2019 has been what's led to the initial R&D wave of AI. It wasn't just investors in the same way. It wasn't subprime lending. That's going to run out, but it's not going to collapse in the same way the housing market and stuff will. In fact, what we may see is the housing market, starting with the commercial and then going down, collapse first. We are seeing strategic signs of actual weakness there for the first time in like 15 years.
Finally, Jesus, you and me have been talking about that for years, Varn. I'm sick of waiting. God right. Damn it.
Well, I mean, we're seeing it, but again, how, just like with the housing fallout in China, how they're going to leverage it. The issue that you have in the United States is that if you want your currency to stay part of the Forex bundle, there's only two ways to do it. To produce enough that people want to buy, that they need your currency to buy, or to have a bond market that people trust enough to have your currency propped up by the bond market. Otherwise, MMT conditions that people always, you know, that leftists always get all happy about means you don't have to tax anyone, only are true within the country, and no country produces everything it needs. Mm. So you can have a great voucher system in your own country. If you can't get steel and rare minerals or whatever because you don't produce enough of it yourself because your currency is useless outside of your own borders, it's over. So if the United States government starts servicing its debt, the bond market falls and the dollar gets de-dollarization accelerates, which it's already beginning to do. That it is clear that Trump wants some de-dollarization to be able to get rid of some of the debt leverages on the bond market.
He always has, yeah.
Right. But if you have too much of it, it's hard to get people outside of our country to buy our stuff and like, you're also impoverishing your own country by doing it. So who's going to be your internal market? Which seems to be the problem that Trump's having, because while we can talk about how capital has weathered this well, productive capital has not.
Yeah.
The trade deficit has gotten worse. Manufacturing jobs has shrunk faster than even other sectors. Yep. Like the very thing that people were told Trumpism was going to revive has been hit the hardest by Trump.
I mean, like reshoring.
Hit that. Reshoring has not happened at all.
He's not really talking about it anymore. That was like his thing a year ago, but.
Right, because it's not possible, and he knows it. I mean, I he's betting on the same weird God AI that everyone else is, because otherwise they're in a predicament that they can't get out of.
But you know what he's talking about more is that all the money that's coming in from the tariffs, which is like I think the Times article says like $200 billion, which is really nothing compared to the damage it's doing to that everything you just mentioned.
And it's nothing compared to our deficit.
$200 billion is like what?
We have a $36 trillion.
20 times more what it costs to join the Board of Peace or whatever.
Right. And we have a $36 trillion deficit. So it's going to take a lot of multiples of $200 billion to even start paying that down, let alone.
No, he's basically exacerbated the problem that they were supposed to fix with the quote unquote Mar-a-Lago Accords that no one talks about anymore because it didn't work. Mm. I find it interesting that, you know, aside from some stalwarts like Ted Reese, the Marxists have like been pretending this isn't happening. Look, we are actually looking at the structural conditions for the kind of crisis that we've always talked about. And now we're not talking about it anymore because we've, I guess, shot our load on predicting them. Way too many times.
I think that's part of it for me, and this is just me personally, because I've been a crisis guy. You know, Andy's been one. We've all been crisis guys, right? Is that we are in such, it feels to me, uncharted territories now that like I'm not prepared to even bring to bear any of the analytical categories that existed in the past, because things are very incoherent right now, and I'm not even sure where one will begin. I guess maybe I should check in with our friend, our Grossmanite friends, to see where they're going with things. But in the meantime, I feel like we're in like an epochal moment, like the 1970s, where we're shifting from one thing to another, and the volatility is kind of the point, you know?
Oh yeah, I mean, no, look, I am a crisis theorist in the sense that I still believe in a business cycle, and it gets worse and worse over time the less you're able to manage it, and these management cycles get shorter and shorter. Like if you look at Keynesian management versus neoliberal versus whatever this second half of neoliberalism in one country, post neoliberalism if you don't understand what neoliberalism is, whatever you want to call it, I think what you are going to see is like this period of management's also going to be very quick, but it doesn't mean that capital is dead. And it doesn't even mean that we're necessarily going to have a world war. I mean, that's the thing that Marxists also pull out is like, okay, so our financial crisis didn't happen. So we have overproduction. We must be heading towards a world war. And I'm like, well, nukes really complicate that. And I just don't think it's as automatic as that either. The thing is though, the idea that the economy had somehow transcended the business cycle, which a lot of leftoids have been floating for the last 15 years.
If not in the United States, at least in China.
Right. It's just not true.
Yeah.
No, and I'm not going to talk about China because I have people tell me stuff about China now that I'm like, I look it up and I'm like, China says they're doing the opposite of what you're saying they're doing. You're steel manning policy off of your projections. So, you know, my example of that is like China's youth unemployment rate is double ours. It's gotten better because we have opened up a lot of world markets to them, but it's still really high. And for a supposedly state planned communist country that can handle everything, that seems fucking weird. So, you know, why is that? You know, why, you know, China doesn't have it quite as bad as like the social democratic countries in Europe, which we also don't talk about that much anymore. But everywhere is having a youth unemployment crisis. Ours is the least bad in the developed world. And it's still pretty bad.
Well, we got podcasting.
We got clavicular.
And streaming,
Streaming and we other got
becoming
forms of
socialist mayor.
Well, let me just try to make that the shift to the political crisis point I was trying to make earlier, and then maybe we can jump into the fun half. I think you know, in terms of like the confrontation with Trump that we saw a bit with the Greenland thing of people dumping U.S. bonds to try to get him to cool off on that. Now the Supreme Court ruling against him. And then also the drawdown in Minneapolis, which I'm following some debate from friends and listeners in Minneapolis who I've been chatting with about what's going on the ground there. And in all these situations, there has to be some level of organizing to confront Trump's excesses here. And obviously the easiest force of organization is going to be from various factions of the capitalist class, because they're already kind of naturally organized in terms of supply chains and such. You know, it's much harder for emergent groups to organize, whether it be Silicon Valley. Obviously, they've done a lot of organizing over the last decade to become a major force, a more major force than they were. The whatever factions, you know, benefit or trade from volatility, the just purely lumpen kleptocratic aspects of the capitalist class that Trump obviously is closely aligned with. But, you know, what if we're talking as Marxists about how to confront the next crisis, how to stop a war or stop ICE or what have you, the question is, how does the class organize? And I think in terms of the last year, what we've seen is that the class has organized in these sort of ad hoc de facto ways to confront ICE, at first spontaneously and then with higher levels of organization, like what we've seen in Minneapolis. And I agree with you, Varn. It was very effective in terms of making it into enough of an optics crisis for the Trump administration that he had to retool the entire mobilization. And so what we're seeing now in Minneapolis is less of these kinds of you know, rounding up people of color in urban areas with these operator like heavily like militarized troop like federal agents, and more undercover agents doing similar things in the suburbs. And I think this is what we're going to see over the next year is less invasions of cities and more stuff going on in the hinterlands and the peripheries of cities, more low key, harder to mobilize to. This is what we saw in Trump's first term too. Not only the abolish ICE movement, the Occupy ICE movement, forcing ICE to relocate their detention centers and operations far outside of cities so people couldn't rally there and surround them. But then also the capitalist class organizing against the tariffs and greatly weakening Trump's ability to do things from, you know, from within the capitalist dictatorship. And so, yeah, I guess we do just have to think about who's organizing against Trump. And obviously the capitalists are going to have a much easier way of it because they are already very organized.
Well, on one hand, I agree they are very organized. On the other hand, I think
compared to us, compared to us, and compared to the parties,
right. I mean, capital's weak historic, but from its historic grounding. But maybe we should talk about this in the fun part.
Okay. Yeah, let's go to the fun part, guys. If you are not patrons of our show, I don't know what you're doing by now. Right, like fucking get it together. Go to patreon.com/thiswreckage. And then if you are not a patron of Varn Vlog, where can they find you, Varn?
You can find me at patreon.com/VarnVlog. Or if you just want to follow for the free stuff, you can find me on YouTube and or any place where fine interview podcasts are downloaded.
What's some of the stuff that you're doing on Varn Vlog that people should check out?
Right now, I'm actually creating a bunch of self-study programs for some people to have, like, I got tired of people complaining about how I don't explain stuff. So I started doing these programs to explain stuff. They're available completely free. I'm also
those are really good, by the way. You are very good at explaining really complicated philosophical and economic stuff.
Almost
really,
like he's a teacher or something.
I put that stuff on my TV and play chess and watch it, and my brain grows.
Yeah. So right now I'm covering the history of the term imperialism, like why Marxists often don't know what we talk about when we use the term, because the term has meant different things every about 15 years. But we don't often acknowledge that the historical definitions have changed, as has what we think is the mechanism of imperialism, whether or not it's dumping into foreign markets for trade super profits, are exploiting labor because of uneven development, or exploiting extraction and through so-called primitive accumulation. You know, we often use those interchangeably, but they're not the same thing at all. And like, which country counts as imperialist actually changes depending on how, I mean, the United States does all of them, so don't worry, we're always going to be imperialist. But the other imperial powers changes on how you look at it, and you start getting to like some weird conclusions. Like if you're an underdevelopmentalist, you would actually claim that until the Green Party and the SPD screwed up the German energy sector, that it was actually being imperialized, not being an imperialist because it was a net exporter.
All right, that was a good teaser. We'll be back in the Varn Zone with the Sigma Marxist after this break.
See you there.
Victory and peace.